Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandegrift.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. A Chinese construction scandal in the Pacific leads the U.S. Labor Department to recover millions of dollars to be paid to immigrant workers. We hear more of their story of how they were tricked into working overseas.
Dr. Peter Mills is a historian with an alternative view of Hawaii's 19th century Russian adventure and the story of Paula'ula Fort Elizabeth.
And we explore Kaka'ako, past and present, in an upcoming walking tour as we mark Architecture Month.
Director Chris Kahuna-Hana's first feature-length film, Waikiki, is a deliberate move away from the sun, sand, and surf genre. It's more of a view from the urban streets.
It's Monday, April 2nd. The conversation starts now, right after the news. The U.S. Labor Department recently moved to recover $14 million from a Chinese company on behalf of workers brought over to the tiny island of Saipan to work on a casino and who were shortchanged in their pay. Bloomberg News broke the story detailing hardships the workers endured on a job site after a number of injuries and the death of a worker caught the attention of federal authorities. In a follow-up story, Associated Press reporter Sophia Yan tracked down some of those workers who returned home after their ordeal and who shared how they were tricked into taking the job overseas.
They were found to have brought over a number of workers illegally from China to work. Now, what had happened to these workers, I've spoken to a lot of them since then, they were tricked into this work. A lot of them borrowed tons of money to pay off these recruiters, these job placement fees, as high as $17,000. If you're living in China in poverty, you're lucky to have a couple of thousand a year in your pocket. And so $17,000, you can imagine, is a lot for them to pay. So they were tricked into that work. They came over to Saipan and discovered that they were here on illegal status. A lot of the agents that had recruited them had actually promised that they would have legal work, legal status, and perhaps even a path towards a green card, which for a lot of these workers, they were telling me that once they got to Saipan, it was clear that that wasn't going to be the case. They were working overtime, sometimes 14, 15, 16, even 19-hour days. They were getting paid half what they had been promised back in China. They weren't getting any breaks. Some of them had their passports confiscated, and it was just a huge problem. They were living in dilapidated housing, bunking with many, many other men, and it was not the kind of situation that they had thought they were going to be in when they thought they were coming to America. They thought they were going to be chasing, you know, the American dream.
And when this project was shut down because of the problems of workers getting injured, I think it was one worker killed, a lot of those workers then went back to China, so was it hard to track them down?
Yeah, it's always hard to track down, workers in this case. I was able to find them. I speak Mandarin, and I have worked before as a reporter in China, so I have a lot of connections in terms of being able to find these kinds of people. And so, yes, a lot of them did go back because construction had halted on this casino. Once that worker at one point last year had died, the federal authorities started to look into this whole situation. The FBI conducted a raid. They found passports locked up in a cabinet. They found these spreadsheets that listed certain employees as heigong, which means illegal labor in Chinese. And they found all these thousands of workers that were in the Northern Mariana Islands illegally. So once the authorities started looking again, construction halted. And for a lot of these workers, they'd come from rural parts of China, you know, China's Rust Belt. They were looking for a job that would pay better and more than that they could make at home. So they couldn't afford to stay any longer without a job. They had to go. Some of them have even taken jobs in other countries because they need to make a living for themselves, for their family. A handful have stayed on Saipan because they're still looking to receive what they think is due, what they're owed, back
right.
wages, damages.
And for some of those that borrowed the money, then they have this huge debt that they've got to clear.
Yeah, one of the workers who's still on Saipan, Shui Longtai, I spoke with him. He's in his early 50s. He and his wife came over. They borrowed tons of money. They're the ones who paid about $17,000 to come over for these jobs that they thought they were taking. Their adult son has recently joined them, and he was telling me that he just can't go home because he's really worried about his physical safety. He can't pay off these loans. He's still in debt from an earlier loan that he had about 10 years ago. There was a government program to push greenhouse farming. So he borrowed money to try to do that. It didn't take off. So he owed money from that, borrowed money to come to the States to do this job that he thought he was going to have. And now he's stuck. He's, you know, in debt. He wants to go home, but he can't. And if he's going to go home, he's got to be able to pay everybody back. But again, he's very worried for his physical safety because he's not making the money to be able to do that.
And talk about the visas that they were working under.
Yeah, so for Chinese citizens, they can come in on this particular visa waiver program as tourists for a certain period of time. And so what these companies were doing was essentially exploiting this little loophole for people to come in. There are legal avenues for workers to have legal status, for employers in Saipan, in the Northern Mariana Islands, to bring in foreign workers. A lot of the workforce, actually more than half of the local workforce right now, are foreign laborers, and those are people coming in on certain visas and legal statuses. But in this case, these workers were not coming in that way.
And what about the situation here in Hawaii? I mean, are workers allowed to do that, to come in under a tourist visa and then work?
Well, technically not. I mean, it would be illegal to do that. Anybody, I suppose, could come in on a tourist visa, take a side job, you know, be paid in cash. You know, that's something that could happen. I won't speculate on whether or not it does happen, you know. But in this particular case over in Saipan, it was a very large group of people that were doing that. You know, the thing is with construction, it's the second most common industry for forced labor. That's according to the International Labor Organization. About 25 million people, they estimate, were victims of forced labor in 2016, 60% in the private sector. That's a really large swath of people. So construction is an area that, again, is sort of at risk for this kind of thing to happen, human trafficking, forced labor. I mean, these people, sometimes, you know, it occurs, and it's something that's difficult for authorities to crack down on.
Right. And here in Hawaii, we've had some cases where there were farmers who thought they were going to be working on a farm and ended up working on a fishing boat. And unfortunately, you know, that's the kind of stuff that comes to light when there's either a crime or a situation that allows authorities to kind of hone in and say, what's really going on here?
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of times what happens is some sort of injury or death will occur, or something will happen, and authorities will take a closer look. Because oftentimes, I mean, these people who come in, the workers themselves don't necessarily always realize what their rights should be or could be. They don't know what's due to them. Some of them may not fully understand that they're here illegally. They may not understand that they're breaking the law. They might not even speak English. For these workers that were coming into Saipan, these Chinese workers that I spoke with, a lot of them had never left China. This was their first time out of their country, and a lot of them had come from small backwater villages. It was a totally new experience for them, and they had no idea necessarily what they were getting themselves into. What they knew they had signed up for was what the recruiters had told them, a well-paying job, legal status in the U.S., and a chance to make a lot more money than they could at home.
Now, with this action taken by the U.S. Department of Labor, what assurance do we have that the money is actually going to get into their hands?
Yeah, so some of the workers have been paid. There's a whole swath of them that are still waiting for money. There's a lot of confusion about how much they're owed and how exactly they'll be paid. There are some labor organizers that are sort of liaising between the government and the workers, and these organizers do often deal specifically with Chinese workers in similar situations. And so I know that they're working to track down certain names and passport numbers, for instance, to make sure that the money gets paid out. Now, there are ways to try to counteract this or to prevent this. One of the lawyers I spoke with, he had this idea that companies, especially foreign companies that are operating in the U.S., should be mandated to purchase a wage bond so that if something like this occurs, there's actually money onshore in the U.S. that can be tapped into to pay out to these workers. A lot of foreign companies, of course, their assets are offshore, so getting them to be able to bring that money in to pay everybody out is a different story. In this particular case, a lot of these companies were actually paying the employees in China, even though they were working here in the U.S. So it's very complicated. I mean, it's a very individual basis how they're going to be able to make sure this money is paid out to everyone. Thousands of workers, not a small feat.
Right. And the project, the status of the project in Saipan is what?
So as far as I understand, the construction now in Saipan on this casino hotel has halted. There are not workers working on it. Again, all those laborers that we were talking about have gone home. A lot of them have gone home. And so if construction is to continue, workers either will have to be hired locally or brought in, foreign or maybe other American workers. There are legal avenues to do that. In Pure Pacific, the company that hired the four construction contractors that have to now pay out these fees as settled by the U.S. Labor Department, in Pure Pacific hasn't said anything specifically in the public about how they plan to go about doing that.
Right, but the casino was operating while it was still under construction.
Yeah, so they had sort of a soft launch. They were operating. They were still building out. They have pretty lavish plans for what they want to do out there in Saipan.
Right, and a lot of, I think, attention by the authorities. It really got their attention because there was a lot of money that was going through that little casino out in the tiny island in the Pacific.
Yeah, there have been a lot of allegations of money laundering when it comes to this casino that's in Saipan, Imperial Pacific's casino. There's, you know, it's got tons of money. It was bringing in more, way more money than Macau and Las Vegas, which are traditional hubs for gambling. And those allegations of money laundering, you know, who knows if they're true or not. There's a lot of speculation around it. And, you know, for a Chinese, it's a close place to go if you want to go gamble. It's not legal in China. So if you decide you want to be a high roller and you want to go out there, Saipan's kind of close. You hop on a plane, you go out there and have some fun. So
in just a couple of hours.
In just a couple of hours. Yeah, exactly.
That was Associated Press reporter Sophia Yan, who's been looking into Chinese-related labor stories in the Pacific. Yan has worked with CNN's Hong Kong Bureau and CNBC in China. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, remembering a long-ago alliance between an independent Kauai and Russian traders. But first, your quiz. In Inanda Architecture Month, we pay homage to a Hawaii architect who we lost last year. Frank Haynes died at the age of 96 years. His walking tour of downtown Honolulu, it showcased the wonderful historic buildings from Kuaihau Church to St. Andrews, was dubbed by the building industry as a walk with the legend. Haynes was former president and CEO of Architects Hawaii, who loved telling the stories behind the most significant structures in the downtown Capital District. It was the military that first brought Haynes to Hawaii. Using the GI Bill, he attended Princeton and MIT, and then returned to the islands to begin his life work in architecture. Over his career, he designed notable buildings like Kaiser's Moanalua Medical Center and Honolulu Clinic, and he led the restoration of the Liulani Hale Judiciary Center. He was an advocate of pedestrian-friendly spaces and designed Bishop Square downtown. He also designed several luxury hotels in Asia. Haynes said he was particularly proud of the interior courtyard of the Prince Kuhio Federal Building, where he hoped workers could appreciate a space to get away from their office cubicles. Haynes had fond memories of his first office on Oahu. It was really a converted garage in a small home in the heart of Waikiki. We're looking for the name of the street where he got his start with the firm that became Lemon, Freeth, and Haynes. If you know the answer, give us a call. The winner gets a tote bag with bragging rights. You got it right. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Paulo'ulo'o Pipo, the site of Fort Elizabeth, the fort built on Kauai by Russian trading interests in the early 19th century, is best remembered as the setting for the brief alliance between the Russian-American Company and Kauai's high chief, Kaumualii. But there's more than one story behind what is now a national historic landmark. Dr. Peter Mills is giving a talk called Revisiting Paulo'ulo, Sacred Wahipana on Kauai, later this month. He's with us from his UH Hilo office. Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be on, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What got you interested in this story? It's a wild story, isn't it?
it's a circuitous route. I had gone off to grad school at Berkeley to be an archaeologist working in Alaska on fur trading and on contact period sites, but I was enrolled at Berkeley, and as soon as I got there, I met Professor Patrick Kirch, who is very well known in the Pacific, and realized he was a pretty brilliant guy to study with, too. And I suddenly realized there was one of these Russian-American company fur trading forts right in the Hawaiian Islands. And since I'm bad at commitment, I thought that was a great way to combine interests in both places.
Well, let's set the stage, because it is kind of The whole idea of a Russian Kauai alliance in 1819 is a pretty far fetched story to begin with, isn't it? Can you kind of set the stage for us?
Yeah, it's really, there's the sign on the highway still says Russian Fort out front, and I'm sorry to say I think it's an awful way to introduce the site to people. The Russian American company had come down in 1815, very early 1815, a Russian American company ship had wrecked at Waimea, Kauai, called the Bering. And eventually in 1816, Yegor Anton Sheffer had come down to recover the goods from it and had signed an alliance with Kaumualii to try to protect Kauai from Kamehameha.
Yeah.
And it was that alliance that sort of led to this flurry of building of a number of fortifications on the island. The one that we're referring to, Pa'ula'ula, is the Hawaiian name for it, and it was part of King Kaumualii's own residential compound, his own kauhale in Waimea, whereas Fort Alexander and Fort Barclay up on the north shore of Kauai were kept by Russian-American company employees and it built by them, whereas the fort in Waimea was built largely with Native Hawaiian labor for King Kaumualii.
And Kauai was independent at that time.
That's the funny part is 1810 is that when everybody cites that the Hawaiian Islands reunited when Kaumualii and Kamehameha had formed an alliance. What people leave out of the history because it makes it messy is that during the War of 1812, Kaumualii had again broken away from Kamehameha and had stopped paying him a tribute. And that's very clearly documented in a number of ships' journals in 1814 before the Russians ever show up. But then the War of 1812 ended. All of the Americans left Kaumualii with no foreign alliance, and within a matter of weeks, this Russian-American company vessel wrecks on his shore in front of his very own house, and he takes all of the material, and in the period of a year, the Russians are down there forming an alliance with him to help continue protecting his sovereignty from Kamehameha.
Which didn't last very long, right?
No, it didn't. The Russians were kicked out really by the middle of 1817, and so there's only a period of about 7 months between the building of this thing that we call a Russian fort and the departure of the Russians. There's no evidence that they had ever garrisoned there, and I honestly think that it was always in Kaumualii's mind his fort that he was building, and he was adopting European kinds of designs to the fortification. And I honestly think there was probably a great deal of Hawaiian ritual that was still at play in his taking of this monumental architecture and using all of his people to build this place.
Well, Peter, if there never was a Russian garrison there, then the term Russian fort becomes, by definition, a misnomer, doesn't it?
It does. It's really like referring to the Statue of Liberty as French statue or as Iolani Palace is American Florentine Palace. You know, there is a connection in the sense that Russians were there, but it really wasn't ever in the control of the Russians. It was always Kaumualii's fort. And I feel the name Pa'ula'ula, which shows up in 19th century documents, Mahele documents, as a much more appropriate name.
Well, as part of any revisionist historian's project, you're going against the cliche of Kamehameha as a unifier of the islands, because, as all historians know, one man's unifier is another man's conqueror, right?
It's true. Kamehameha was an amazing character, and he did so much to bring the islands together. But it's really messy with Kauai, and for good reason. Kaumualii, I think, ends up being ignored in so much of 19th century history as a sort of a secondary player when he really was such an incredibly central figure on Kauai.
It seems that way, and eventually, by force of essentially Kauai ceded to the larger kingdom by force of arms, but without a battle. He simply was because there were just too many forces arrayed against him. Is that right?
Well, not quite. There was actually, in 1824, this place that we call a Russian fort is where there was a battle between Kaumualii's son, Humehume, and some allied chiefs from Kauai to try to keep Kauai under the control of Kauai chiefs. This is after Kamehameha had died. And the battle was really mostly between Kalani Moku and these Kauai chiefs. Eventually, the Oahu Big Island Aligned chiefs put down the Kauai Rebellion in 1824. Another thing which helped unify the islands was that after Kamehameha died was that Ka'ahumanu married Kamuali'i, and that marriage in 1821 again sort of very much serves to have brought the islands together in a way that hadn't been done before.
And that was very much a royal marriage of convenience and not so much a love match, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that's well, that's kind of how things were done in those days. But, you know, as what you've said, the real history is so often messier than the soundbite history, isn't it?
It is indeed, and it's something that words do matter, and the ways that we introduce places to people do matter. And it's I think it's high time that we start to realize the incredible significance of this National Historic Landmark, but not because of the Russian presence, but because of its significance to Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian cultural change in the 19th century and this incredibly important battle for sovereignty on Kauai, all which unfolded in this very small area of land.
Maybe it's time to change that highway sign.
I think so.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Dr. Peter Mills is a professor of anthropology at the University of Hawaii Hilo. He'll give a talk on revisiting Pa'ula'ula Sacred Wahipana on Friday, April 20th at the Waimea Theater in Waimea, Kauai. It's free and open to the public, and you can learn more about it on our Facebook page.
River Valley, where I used to play, canyons of Waimea, standing all alone. The magic of the garden now is calling me back home.
No one could have predicted at the time that the alleged theft of a mailbox in June of 2013 would become the most wide-ranging police corruption scandal in state history. It's a case that gets curiouser and curiouser as the Justice Department continues its investigation, an investigation that paints a troubling picture of sworn law enforcement officials lying to one another. Nick Gruby has a story in today's Reality Check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Okay. You make a reference in your headline to blind faith. Whose blind faith was it?
Well, I think this really is a story about one law enforcement agency just having implicit trust in another law enforcement agency. And I think in this particular case, you have the U.S. Attorney's Office being told things. Well, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the U.S. Postal Inspector's Service being told by numerous officials from the police chief and his wife, who's a city prosecutor, and several other police officers saying, hey, somebody stole our mailbox and we're pretty sure this is the guy who did it. Mm-hmm. Now, from the U.S. Attorney's perspective, why would you think that another law enforcement agency and several people who are working for it are potentially lying to you? And so that's where I think the blind faith aspect comes in, is, you know, law enforcement tends to trust one another.
Well, it usually works, doesn't it?
Well, I think this piece sort of highlights the unique nature of this particular case. I mean, we have two of the main characters in the piece are longtime, one is a longtime federal prosecutor, another is a longtime federal public defender. And both of them say they've never seen anything like this that sort of stretches out as far as it does. And of course, this is a case that has already resulted in the indictment of six individuals, all of them in law enforcement. It's resulted in another former police officer pleading guilty to conspiracy and an alleged victim pleading guilty to conspiracy after it admitting to lying to a federal grand jury. And remember, this investigation is still ongoing. Yeah. The U.S. Department of Justice still has its special prosecutor, Michael Wheat, looking into other allegations of potential corruption within not only the police department, but now also the Honolulu Prosecuting Attorney's Office.
Nick, one of the things that's always struck me about this case, and correct me if I'm wrong, but because it was a mailbox, that's what made it federal, right?
Well, so that was the federal charge, was destruction of a mailbox. But you have to remember that this case started off with the Honolulu Police Department investigating it. They controlled the investigation from mm-hmm. beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And what that meant, they were initially looking at this as a theft case. And at the time, there was a law in the books that said in order for a theft to be considered a felony, the items that had been stolen had to be above $300 threshold.
Right.
Now, when you look at the evidence in the police reports in this case, the K-Alohas had said that their mailbox cost more than $300, which of course would have resulted in a felony charge in state court. Turns out that mailbox actually didn't cost that much. It was about half the price, which is one of the revelations that this story sort of explores a little bit. And so then the way the sort of allegations unfold is the U.S. Postal Inspector became involved with the case because, again, it did involve the mailbox.
That's what made it federal.
And that's when you lose control.
Exactly. Nick, we've got to run. Thanks very much for checking in with us.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris.
That was investigative reporter Nick Gruby with today's Reality Check. And to read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
News that just skims the surface? I mean, it's kind of like running a damp paper towel over a countertop and saying that you cleaned, right? This is David Green, and when you support public radio, you pay for journalists who roll up their sleeves and scrub. We get in there. So you can either stuff 2 weeks' worth of clutter into a closet and hope the door stays shut, or invest in the reporting that gets the job done. Here's how to do it.
Become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org.
These days, Kaka'ako skyline's quickly changing. It's fast becoming an edgy, modern gathering place with new eateries, new retail space, and lots of luxury high-rises. But Kaka'ako has a rich history, and some landowners are incorporating the past into the design of this emerging community. With us this morning is Aki Yoshida. She's with the Honolulu chapter of the American Institute of Architects and also the chair of the group that's organizing this tour. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is just one of several things you folks have got going for Architecture Month.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are some of the other events that you've got going?
So the first event is going to be on Thursday. We have a Picha Kucha event. And those of you not familiar with Picha Kucha style presentation, it's 20 slides, 20 seconds. So it's a quick pace presentation. We'll have 10 people presenting from all over the discipline, not just architects. So.
Right, and then a lot of the firms also open up their offices, right?
Yeah, that's on Friday. That's a firm crawl. Basically, the firm opens up for the night and just have drinks and food and just kind of look at what architects' office look like.
Right, so kind of come get to know us.
Exactly.
event.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell us about this tour. This is really kind of a showcase of the month, and,
yeah.
and this time it's Kaka'ako.
Mm-hmm. So a walking tour is going to be in April 28th, 3 to 6 p.m. It's going to start at the IBM building, the iconic building in Kaka'ako, and we're going to have 8 stops. So along the way, so we're going to divide people up in different groups, and we are going to walk along 1.5 miles, which will take about 2 hours for the entire tour.
Now, I've been on some of these tours, and mm-hmm. you really learn so much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting because with this space, you've got lots of emerging high-rises and mm-hmm. various stages of construction. And so the idea is to blend then some of that history with the modern plan for that community.
Yeah, exactly. So we will have IBM building, which has been there for a long time. And we're also going to tour some of the new high-rises residential buildings on Kamakei Street. And we're also going to go down to Arts Loft, which is under construction. So that's going to be a little piece of future of Kaka'ako. And we're also going to go to Blaisdell, which has been there for a while.
Right, and there's lots of talk now about possibly revisioning that property and making improvements, maybe
modernizing that structure.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people don't know about that, so that I definitely going to think that would be very interesting.
And that was all part of the Ward Estate, and I believe they've got natural springs that help.
To feed the pond.
Right. So a really kind of a nice past and present connection.
Yeah, exactly.
And so where else will you go from there?
And after Bladesdale, we'll go to where you can see Keiki Lohana, which is under construction. And there's a lot of talks about affordable housing. And, you know, that's another piece of future.
Right. And that's the reserve housing.
Reserve housing. Hughes. Exactly. Yep.
Now, the master plan I know in Kaka'ako really calls for, a number of high-rises. I think Howard Hughes may have a couple of dozen that they could possibly build out over time.
Mm-hmm.
There's also Kamehameha Schools is the other large landowner in that area, and they've got the collection and other projects underway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really,
so that would be definitely part of the conversation and the master plan and the history of Kaka'ako.
So is the idea then you are able to talk about these new buildings that you can see and talk about the design?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. What's the idea behind it and why the architects decided to put, you know, this building is inspired by water, this building is inspired by birds, and, you know, details what the inspirations are, what we talked about.
It really is exciting because you go down there and it's you've got this energy that you see happening. A lot of the young people are going down into that area with all the new, bars and restaurants and cafes. So it really is a vibrant community.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's what the Kaka'ako's future is going to be.
And so when you were planning this tour, like what was some of the criteria maybe that you considered in choosing some of the buildings and some of the stops along the way?
So we definitely wanted it to be historically significant buildings, but we didn't just want to be focusing on the past. So obviously all these buildings are going up, and there's some controversial, there's some, you know, there's a lot of talks about it. So what we wanted to do as AI Honolulu to kind of bridge the gap between these new buildings that sometimes have negative connotations and what architecture can build the gap between, bridge the gap between the public and the public and who's actually building it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was definitely the criteria.
And then, I don't know, anything else that might make this tour a little bit different from the ones you've had in the past, like Waikiki?
I would say if I have to pick one place that people, I think, would be surprised about, it would be the McCoy Pavilion. So it's right next to Ala Moana Beach Park, and I can guarantee you a lot of people don't even know that exists. So, and it's actually a piece of gem, basically. It's like urban oasis. So I think that would be a definitely interesting spot.
Right, and everybody loves Ala Moana Beach Park, and maybe you can provide a little bit more context and history behind that structure
there. Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us this morning, Aki. That was AIA Honolulu's Aki Yoshida talking about the upcoming walking tour of Kaka'ako as part of Architecture Month. For a list of all the events, you can log on to our page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the astonishing story of the Siamese twins Chang and Ang, who were brought to America in 1829, exploited and displayed as freaks. Eventually, they took charge of their own career, became rich, married two sisters, and fathered 21 children. We talk with Yunta Huang about his new book, Inseparable. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, also what we can try and observe in our dark island skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have in store for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Jupiter rising in the east just after 9 p.m. The moon will be passing through its last quarter phase, so towards week's end, we can expect perfect conditions for stargazing.
And there is quite a bit of stargazing going on in the Aloha State, where we have one of the most massive astronomy centers, and that's, of course, at the Mauna Kea Summit. And I understand you have some news relating to some of the research there, and we're going to learn a little bit about research relating to dark matter.
Indeed. The Gemini North Observatory and the Keck Observatory have teamed up with the Hubble Space Telescope and several other observatories around the world to bring us an unprecedented look into a type of galaxy that has never been seen before, that appears to be completely devoid of dark matter. And its name is NGC 1052.
Of course it is. And so if dark matter's dark, how do we know this galaxy has none?
Well, that's an excellent point. In fact, we never directly see dark matter precisely because it doesn't emit or reflect enough visible light. But we can infer its presence by looking at matter we can see, such as stars.
I'm assuming dark matter has some sort of gravitational effect on the things around it.
Exactly. As we've said many times before here on Stargazer, in astronomy, what you cannot see can be just as important as what you can see. In this case, the observatories looked at the visible structure of this galaxy and found that the influence of dark matter was missing.
Explain why this is important and what dark matter does for a galaxy.
Well, dark matter is a key component in the evolution and structure of a galaxy. It's dark matter that can give rise to star formation, and it's responsible for keeping galaxies like our own Milky Way together. If we took dark matter away, our galaxy would fluff up to resemble a giant spherical cloud of stars, vastly more uninteresting than it is today.
And while this newly discovered galaxy seems to be one of a kind, do you think there's more out there in the massive universe?
Indeed I do. Lurking out there somewhere, there has to be more. However, as to precisely what gave rise to this particular type of galaxy, right now, that's a mystery.
Well, we'll leave that to a future Stargazer report for you to try to unravel for us. It's Christopher Phillips, and we appreciate your time as always.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary and 15 years of support for the Hawaii Architectural Foundation. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, FerraroChoi.com.
Earlier in today's backyard quiz, we paid homage to Honolulu architect Frank Haynes. Haynes was fondly remembered for his limber gait as he led the downtown walking tour he started decades ago. Over the course of that 2.5-hour tour, he shared rich stories behind the remarkable structures and their place in Hawaii history. In 2009, he was honored by the Historic Hawaii Foundation with the establishment of the Frank Haynes Award to recognize individuals who stand out in the area of preserving the historic and cultural places of Hawaii. Haynes retired from Architects Hawaii, and he's born on April 7, 1921, would have turned 97 this week. He earned his master's in architecture from MIT in 1948, moved to Hawaii to begin his career. His first office was in a humble house in Waikiki on Saratoga Road, and that was the answer we were looking for today. Nobody got it, but that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii offers endless opportunities for filmmakers, and as background has filled in for any number of exotic locales ever since the silent movie days. But the story of life here, as it is lived by the people who live here, is all too rarely told. Director Christopher Kahuna-Hana's first full-length feature is called Waikiki, and it's a deliberate challenge to the cliched view of life in the islands. His film is a work in progress, and we spoke about it the other day.
There's an unlimited global demand for the idea of Hawaii as a paradise. And so when you think of Waikiki, it conjures up all these images of beautiful sandy beaches, mm-hmm. Paradise.
A getaway.
Yes, a getaway. But for the people who live here, we understand that it's not always so simple. Paradise is something that does exist, but we don't get to live it every day.
How does your story reflect that?
I wanted to show Hawaii in every aspect of it. It's beauty, it's struggle, it's connection, it's humanity, and its difficulties. And I thought the only way to do that was to take a character, someone that we all know. She's the average Hawaii girl, grows up here, works hard, has three jobs, you know, struggles to survive. She's saving money to get her own place. But as you know, Hawaii has one of the highest rental prices, mm-hmm. highest property prices, and so it's hard. So she struggles to try to make ends meet. And this is something I think we from Hawaii intimately understand. I think a lot of people are feeling the same thing. It's not as easy as people think it is.
Everyone, to some degree, who lives in Hawaii has, it seems as if we all feel some degree of obligation to kind of sell Hawaii, represent the state at its best, you know, show Hawaii for the place that we've come to love living in. What is the effect of that sort of dark side view, do you think, on viewers?
You know, I don't think it's a dark side. I think it's just, it's realistic. It's an authentic point of view. It's like, as a Kanaka Maoli, you know, these are issues that we grew up with. It's like mm-hmm. we see how hard it is for our parents to, you know, send their kids to school, keep a roof over their heads. And it's tough. I mean, we all know Hawaii has one of the highest per capita homelessness in the nation. Mm-hmm. So it's like, as much as people want to believe Hawaii is only a beautiful paradise, it's realistically, there's a lot of people struggling.
How does the story of your film, give me, if you would, a quick sort of outline of the story and tell me how that reflects your theme.
So the story's kind of an allegory, and it's a tragedy, and it's we follow a girl on her normal life trying to make ends meet, and she runs into a person who she befriends, and they go on this journey together, and through that process they form a friendship, and we soon realize that these people's lives aren't as, you know, as simple as we would seem to want them to be. It's not as idyllic. It's they need each other. They need friendship. They need connection to community. They need family. So simple plots, boy meets girl, friendship, and then, you know, how those things work out.
A journey.
Out. It's a journey, yeah.
A discovery.
Journey of discovery, yes, yes. But that's the simple plot. And, you know, being from Hawaii, we have this thing called kauna. Mm-hmm. Kauna is alternate meanings, deeper meanings than simple thought, simple ideas. Mm-hmm. So it acts as an allegory for the greater story, which is about she represents what Hawaii has been going through. We follow the awai, or the water from the sky all the way through the ocean, and its disruption causes disruptions within our community. And it affects the health, the mental health, the sustainability of the land. All these issues come into play and affect the characters in the screenplay.
What does Waikiki as a title come to mean in the course of this story?
So Waikiki, from a Hawaiian perspective, it translated means bubbling water. And it's because the rain from the mountain would flow in through Waikiki and come up through the land. It was mm-hmm. very fertile. Mm-hmm. But we all know what happened is that they built the Alawai. They plugged up the natural flow of water mm-hmm. to build Waikiki. And so as they spent, you know, billions of dollars annually to promote this idea of an idyllic sandy beach, you know, if we, you know, we can just walk out and look at the Alawai and realize that's not accurate.
It's kind of an artificial environment, right? It's a wetland that got filled in.
Mm-hmm.
It were it in its original state, it wouldn't support high-rise hotels.
No, they have to change the topography of the land. They have to change the flow of the water in order for them to be able to build, you know, the hotels to sustain the economy of visitor industry.
And every once in a while, you've got to add sand to those beaches, or else you're not going to have those either.
And that's a controversial topic, but you know, we pull a lot of the sand to build all our high rises and our freeways from Maui, and in that sand, you know, it's my Iwi Kupuna, so it's my people are in those sands, and you know, them using it to build these high rises, you know, it's disheartening a lot of times.
Is that going to emerge as we hear your story in the film?
You know, there's a lot of this story, because it's a difficult story to tell, which touches on a lot of sensitive issues. It was hard to write. You know, it's not a documentary, so I'm not trying to present it as fact.
Like, right.
This is the way things are. I just want to say this is the environment that these characters live in. You know, we're affected by noise pollution. So, you know, as they're, you know, driving on the side of the road, we just get bombarded with, like, the sound of traffic and mm-hmm. people and construction, the constant pounding into the aina, you know, of these big, you know, yeah. And all day, every day, you can't go without hearing helicopters fly overhead constantly, or jets, military jets or planes. Mm-hmm. And we're talking like in our valleys. We're talking about as far away from the airport as you can get on this island, and you still can't escape the sound of just like modernity. And I think all these things affect people on a subconscious level. And I think hopefully people will feel that through the film.
Those pressures of modernity, that direction is not going to get reversed, right?
No, it's not. It's not.
So what's your take on our future based on that?
Well, I think in a lot of places, they're returning and understanding the value of native understandings of nature and native connection to nature. And as so a lot in science, they're discovering a lot of things that the native people knew for a long time.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think what there becomes a problem when we just say this one culture is the what humanity encompasses, only this culture. As we lose languages, we lose understanding, we lose Ike. As we lose the Hawaiian language, Olelo Hawaii, mm-hmm. we lose a lot of the understandings of our environment. I think in order to create a more sustainable, healthy environment for all Hawaii citizens, global citizens, we have to reconnect to our to the aina, to the land, to, you know. So in the film, it comes down to this one olelo no'eau, which is he ali'i ka aina, he kawa ke kanaka, he ali'i ka aina, he kawa ke kanaka, which means the land is the chief. The people are merely its servants. So we are responsible for the land versus seeing the land as a commodity to, you know, profit off of or to make money off of. Mm-hmm. Or it's like we need to take care of the earth, and the earth will take care of us.
Christopher Kahuna-Hana is the director of Waikiki, which is currently in production. You can learn more about it on our Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the film series European Cinema 2018, now through May 1st. HonoluluMuseum.org.
We have to go, but up tomorrow we talk about the problem of feral cats and toxoplasmosis and the threat it poses to Hawaii wildlife and public health, and we'll be taking your calls.
We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at talkback@HawaiiPublicRadio.org or post comments on Facebook at The Conversation.
If you missed any of this show, check our conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.